Okay. Well, let me just start talking anyway, just to... first of all, I think the first thing you need to know about me is I'm actually someone all of whose degrees have been interdisciplinary, okay? And in this respect, from a very early age, I realized that disciplines weren't quite what they were cracked up to be. So when I was when I took my first degree at Columbia University, my major was history and sociology, but that wasn't necessarily because I had some sort of strong commitment to that combination of views, the combination of disciplines, but rather it was because they actually had the fewest requirements, which allowed me to take the most elective subjects outside of the major. Okay? My master's degree and PhD were in history and philosophy of science, which is a very interdisciplinary field to begin with. And in a sense, that field actually grounded my kind of commitment to interdisciplinarity, especially when I moved into the field of science and technology studies. I mean, for some of the younger people in the audience, you may not quite realize that in a sense, history and philosophy of science is kind of, in a way, the precursor of science and technology studies. And I think it's really important when we think about the role that science and technology studies plays, both as an interdisciplinary field and as a field that studies interdisciplinarity, what its relationship is to its precursor. Because the thing about history and philosophy of science is that the reason why this field sort of originated, let's say in the late 1950s, early 1960s, and we think about people like, you know, Popper, Kuhn, Lakatos, Paul Feyerabend, and all these kinds of guys who were involved, was that there was a kind of limitation in terms of what each of the fields, especially history and philosophy, could provide with regard to a full understanding of science in a period, which was the Cold War period, right, where, as it were, the standing of science suddenly was becoming incredibly important in society more than ever before. It was kind of driving the way in which society was going, but in ways that many people found very problematic in all kinds of ways, ranging from issues having to do with nuclear war to the environment and all the rest of it. And the problem with history and philosophy staying apart was that, in a sense, history was seen as just focused on the past, and in a sense, a very kind of archival sense of the past without any kind of normative horizon. Now, philosophy, of course, has a normative horizon, but philosophy's normative horizon is very abstract. It's not necessarily tied to anything that could be actionable and so forth. And so one of the things that happens over the course of the history and philosophy of science is a way of trying to bridge this is that actually sociology and the social studies become a much more prominent field, and there you start to begin to see the transition to science and technology studies. Now, the thing is, when I got interested in this field, which was actually as a graduate student back in the early 1980s, my view of this was that actually part of what science and technology studies would do would be to break down the disciplinary barriers separating history, philosophy, and sociology. That in a sense it would lead to a new kind of configuration of how academic knowledge production takes place. In other words, I did not imagine it as a new field that, as it were, would sit alongside of history, science, philosophy of science, sociology of science. Okay? But that's not really what happened. Okay? There is a sense in which science and technology studies kind of exists as a sort of discipline on its own in a way. And those of you who come into this field relatively late, you know, the PhD students and so forth, the way the history of the field now gets told is such that in a sense it's pretty much detached from all this older stuff that people like me were involved in. Right? So people spend a lot of time talking about Latour and Jasanoff and all this kind of stuff as if that's kind of when it got invented. Okay, so we've got like a new field called science and technology studies, right, which is interdisciplinary kind of in the sense that it's promiscuous in its borrowings, but in a way has its own kind of internal dynamic, its own boundary, its own jargon, right, its own journals, you know. So it's kind of a discipline, okay? This wasn't why I got into the field, okay? So in this respect, I'm actually very much a person who believes that interdisciplinarity is always, to a certain extent, anti-disciplinary. Okay? In other words, and especially when we think about the context in which interdisciplinarity is normally invoked, right? So we talk about mode 2 knowledge production, right? And this is the idea that, in a sense, we need to produce knowledge that is relevant to solving society's problems, however that's understood, right? And so the notion of relevance is very important in this kind of thinking. Now, surely when people talk about that, they are not talking about the idea that we still need more disciplines in the academy, right? There's a sense in which the movement is supposed to be outward, not more inward. And one of the big fears I particularly have about the way in which interdisciplinarity gets pursued, even within science and technology studies, is that in a way it's making work for academics within academic contexts, but the topics, as it were, are these external topics that have to do with the real world. Okay? One of the things some of you may know, if you know anything about my work, is that I published a very large book on Thomas Kuhn and his legacy and his significance and things like this about 15 years ago. And there I have a chapter about science and technology studies as a field. This is a book that came out in 2000. And one of the things that I said that was kind of a bit disturbing about science and technology studies is that as an interdisciplinary field, it sort of flourished in this state, the tertius gaudens. Okay, I don't know if you're familiar with this. This is a phrase that comes from Georg Simmel, who's one of the classical sociologists right of the turn of the last century. And he's talking basically about the social phenomena of people who benefit from other people's misery. Right, the third party. The person who's kind of, in a way, maybe even stirring it up a bit and benefiting from it. I've always thought science and technology studies has this kind of tendency to it. And I think the way this kind of tendency gets expressed in terms of the theoretical language of the field is in terms of the shift from epistemology to ontology. The proliferation of objects. Okay, that's like kicking up dust in more colloquial terms. Okay, one of the things about the history and philosophy of science in the period in which I studied, was that there was a lot of issues about the way in which scientists didn't quite understand the way in which they operate in the world, and they have to open up their horizons and so forth, and that history and sociology and philosophy can kind of enable them to do that, to become more progressive, blah, blah, blah. And in a sense, scientific practice could be enriched by that. That was kind of the idea, actually, right? And so people, I mean, and especially if you look at people sort of in the Popperian tradition, right, they were very keen kind of on this, right? That if scientists really had a more sort of self-conscious, self-reflective understanding, they'd be able to do better science, and that involves taking in the knowledge that you can get from history, philosophy, and sociology. That was kind of what the game plan was. So breaking down epistemic barriers that come from the conventional way in which we divide disciplines, right? That was the original idea. Science and technology studies operates differently in the contemporary form. What science and technology studies tends to do is to reveal actors, agents, objects that you otherwise would not see, and as a result, complicates what you do. Right? Science and technology studies, if nothing else, is about complicating things. And I think it's always an open policy question if you're actually someone who's interested in addressing real-world problems, where the complicating things is such a bright idea. Now, admittedly, it keeps science and technology studies researchers in business. And articles get generated, and there's all this kind of stuff going on. People can do research on it. But you have to think about the extent to which science and technology studies as a field flourishes because there are these unresolved controversies. There are all these impasses. There's all these issues that cannot get resolved. And the more you look at them, the more complicated they are, and the more research grants you need to pursue them. Right? It seems to me this is the trajectory of science and technology at this point with regard to its relationship to the stuff that it studies. So it's a kind of form of interdisciplinarity that doesn't involve breaking down epistemic boundaries, but if anything, proliferates them and it actually reifies them to a certain extent. Right? Because it gives voice to everything. Right? Without actually evaluating, comparing, without engaging in kind of the normative work, which in the past something like philosophy would do. Right? And so I do think, you know, when one thinks about what one is trying to do with regard to interdisciplinarity here, it seems to me that science and technology studies is a kind of very Janus-based
sort of entity here. It is not exactly, I would say, it's not exactly an unmitigated good. Right? Some of the world's problems may be solved a lot more quickly without science and technology studies.
Now get a research grant for that. Right? But the point is, I do think that there is a sense in which what is it that, what, you know, so there's this general kind of conceptual point that comes from this, right? Which is, what is it that we're trying to do when we talk about interdisciplinarity? Are we just trying to, as it were, proliferate disciplines, essentially, by creating disciplines that, as it were, mix and match other disciplines to create new ones, which is, I think, science and technology studies sort of does? Or is interdisciplinarity a way of, as it were, a self-critique of disciplines, right? To kind of, as it were, bring together forms of knowledge that are artificially separated because of the disciplinary boundaries that sort of separate them at the moment, okay? And so in this context, one of the things that I've been talking about, I've actually been talking about this now for, 15 years maybe, but I've been writing about it recently because, in case you don't know, there's a lot of interest nowadays. Interdisciplinarity, by the way, is one of these ideas that has a fashion, it's a very fashion-based idea, right? So we're now in a period where it's fashionable. It wasn't fashionable, let's say 10 or 20 years ago even, maybe. But now it's fashionable, and so there's now actually Oxford Handbook on Interdisciplinarity and all this kind of thing. One of the things that's always been very much constant in my thinking about interdisciplinarity is an opposition to the idea of what I call epistemic rent-seeking. So rent-seeking is a notion from economics, and you may be familiar with this. And this is the idea that if you're an owner of property, right, just by virtue of owning it, especially if it's somewhat attractive, right, you can charge these kinds of enormous rents, as it were, even though you're not doing anything with the property, you just happen to own it. Right, and then all the people who want to do something with the land are going to have to pay you these enormous rents. Now, I've always thought of academic disciplines as these rent-seeking entities, right? In the sense that academic disciplines, once they establish a kind of path they go down, right? So in economics, we talk about path dependency, right? So a discipline gets established, it gets a kind of foothold at certain universities and certain journals, it develops a kind of language which gets very much refined over time, so it becomes very clear to get a sense of who knows it and who doesn't know it, right? So you're able to, you know, do an insider-outsider distinction there. And as these things kind of become more and more developed, right, then you establish the rent-seeking mode, right? Because anyone who actually wants to contribute to the area that your discipline is nominally about actually has to start acquiring all these other skills, right? And these skills are actually products of the history of the discipline, right? The fact that a discipline developed in a certain way means that you have to acquire those skills, even though the topic that the discipline is addressing and that it has an effective monopoly on may not actually require all that stuff. You see what I'm saying, okay? Because this is, and so this is the rent-seeking tendency of disciplines. And it's very difficult to break in purely academic terms, because there's a sense in which one of the great things about academic knowledge, even today in our neoliberal times, is it's very highly institutionalized. So there's a reproduction cycle that's very natural and is very much respected. And so we have constantly PhDs being churned out in subjects. We have journals that kind of carry on indefinitely, right? And people are publishing in this way and carrying on and so forth. And so these disciplines actually acquire a life of their own, and so they're able to, as it were, exact, in a sense, higher and higher rents. And so then, you know, and this is where the issue of academic disciplines as a very specific form of expertise becomes very evident in the public imagination. Okay? Now, this is not a new problem. That's one thing I think it's worth pointing out. This is not a new problem. And throughout history, there have been various, you might say, new disciplines, as it were, that promised to get rid of this kind of rent-seeking behavior, okay? And philosophy was one such field in Immanuel Kant's sense, okay? I point this out for historic reasons, right? That In the 1790s, Immanuel Kant wrote this book, The Contest of the Faculties, and it was basically about the way in which in the universities of the time, in the late 18th century, right, you have the theology faculty, medical faculty, law faculty, all these different faculties vying for authority, not being able to reconcile their differences on all kinds of grounds. And Kant says, look, we're going to have a clean slate. We're going to go back to fundamentals. And fundamentals is going to be what philosophy does, and it's going to be kind of this epistemology-led of philosophy, which talks about how you justify your knowledge claims. Right? And that's the familiar kind of notion of epistemology that we have now, basically comes from that, right? As a kind of leveling of the playing field, where everybody will have to transact their knowledge claims in terms of this kind of universal language of thought, which philosophy was the guardian of. And in the rise of the modern university in Germany and so forth, philosophy played a very foundational role in the curriculum in just this way. Okay. Now, as the next couple of centuries rolled on, this kind of aspiration got taken up in various ways, and I think for people of the 20th century, right, positivism would be the thing to look at. Where, right, and again, people do not often give positivism all of its due, but one of the things that you have to say about positivism is it was very suspicious, very contemptuous of expertise based purely on disciplines without a universal conception of knowledge on the back of it. Positivism was about breaking down boundaries. Breaking down boundaries perhaps in ways people didn't like, but it was about what we call reductionism, for example. That's a great example of that, right? Positivism is about reductionism and unification, right? Those are the two rhetorical tropes of positivism, and what are they aiming at? They're aiming at disciplinary differences. Now, of course, particular disciplines, you might say, that are sort of in the vanguard of this movement, like physics, for example, right, turn out to be the lingua franca in practice. And this then causes all kinds of problems, as you know, with regard to whether you can deal with human beings this way and all the rest of it, which is very much part of what the epistemology of the human sciences debates have been about for the last 150 years. But positivism, I would definitely include as being among these kinds of movements whose idea of interdisciplinarity was to break down disciplinary boundaries. And so if you look at the International, Encyclopedia of Unified Science, right, that the logical positivists put out when they moved to the United States, and the last volume of which was Thomas Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, you see this kind of idea of interdisciplinarity in place. I think there's a lot to be said for this, actually, especially if one is trying to think about the ways in which knowledge can be organized and mobilized in a way that can actually not only engage in greater progress within the academic community, but also be of greater relevance to the larger society. Now, I understand, just as much as the rest of you do, that positivism as a kind of rhetorical force is pretty much spent. Right? That however one wishes to cast these notions, of unification and so forth, that the positivist language is not really available for that. Okay? But nevertheless, I do think that there is something in the impetus behind this that is, in fact, worth looking at. Let me see, just get a sense of the time here. Okay, let me carry on. One of the things that's very interesting in terms of how we might go about doing this, how we might go about in this kind of new mode of interdisciplinarity as unification or something like this, is of course the kinds of roles that may be provided by information technology, search engines, things of this kind. I'm not sure if this is actually going to come up in this conference, but I do think that there is a very important, potentially very important role for library and information science to play in any kind of sort of interdisciplinary mapping. Because I mean, and here, let me start with the following point. We all know, anecdotally or maybe with greater precision, that there's an enormous amount of stuff being published out there in the academic world. Okay? Most of it is not cited or not cited very much, and who knows, maybe even more of it isn't read, right? Because you can cite stuff without reading it. People usually say it the other way around, but this is the point I want to make. And so we, in fact, have this enormous kind of stockpile of knowledge out there right? And think about this from the context of getting research grants, right? Because when you go for a research grant, you normally have to do a literature review of some sort to show that, you know, this thing that I'm planning to do require, you know, nobody's done this before, and this is going to be a new thing, and so you have to situate yourself in the literature showing there's this gap and I'm going to fill it. But in fact, right, if you look at the way in which research grants get appraised, this aspect of the process is treated in a relatively superficial manner. Okay? So generally, when you write up these kinds of literature reviews, what you're mainly concerned about, you're sort of anticipating who's going to read it, and you want to make sure if X is going to read it, X is going to be in there, right? So X is providing a foundation for my work, so X will say, ah, Y is going to be building on me, right? But there is no even pretense of having a kind of systematic coverage of all the stuff that's already out there. So as a matter of fact, it is entirely possible, and especially given the way in which academic disciplines are so fractionalized into their specific jargons and so forth, that the wheel may have been reinvented many times and nobody knows. And of course, this is a great waste of money to the taxpayers. Okay? But maybe it keeps people's careers going, right? So in a sense, there is a sort of, in terms of the incentive structure, right, behind the way people are encouraged to pursue research, right, there's not a lot of incentive to actually find out what other people have done. Right? If there's only an incentive to find out those people who might trip you up. Right? And that's where you get kind of your, as it were, your sort of street smarts as an academic researcher. But there is no incentive within academia to actually read everything that's ever been written in the topic that you're working on. There is no incentive. In fact, it wastes your time in terms of the way in which the academy has been accelerating in terms of the way you have to produce outputs and so forth. So what this means is we're in a situation now where in the future it's likely all kinds of stuff is going to be produced and published, and in principle, this is the interesting and ironic point, it'll be more accessible than ever before, but no one will look at it. Okay? Now, how are we going to stop this madness? Because to me, there is a kind of weird madness here, right? And this is very much a time in which we live. So this problem actually was realized 30 years ago. And it goes under the name of undiscovered public knowledge. It's a very nice, polite name for this. Right? So and it's a good name, right? Because there it is. It's there. It's in, you know, it's in the libraries. It's in the databanks. The solutions to our problems have already been found. We just don't know where they are. Right? And if we actually, you know, commission people or somehow design algorithms or search engines or whatever to actually look for this stuff, right? And we actually, as it were, kind of applied our intelligence to that, right? And, you know, then we would actually not only be able to solve a lot of problems much more quickly, perhaps, you know, in that respect, expedite the course of research, but my God, we could even save some money. Neoliberals should love this. Okay? Now, this idea, undiscovered public knowledge, was coined by Don Swanson, who was originally trained in physics, but was a professor of library and information science at the University of Chicago. And in 1986, he published this article in the Library Quarterly where he actually showed how it was possible to come up with a range of hypotheses for curing what's known as Raynaud's disease, which has to do with poor circulation of blood, where your fingertips feel numb and so forth, that by actually reading across literatures in different fields, right? So in other words, the different parts of the puzzle were to be found in different fields, but the people who were the experts in those fields were not in the habit of reading across them. Now, Swanson read across them, and because he was a person who had sort of formal training in science, he understood, you know, what the various things were going on there enough that he was able to, as it were, mobilize a list of hypotheses that could be then tested. And as it were, one of them turned out to be correct. Okay, and this did not involve actually getting a research grant in advance, right? This just involved him doing the search, right? And so this then started this general idea, right, that you know, maybe
if we actually incentivize people to look into the literatures and to think about it in ways that force you to look across disciplinary boundaries in the reading habits. Right? Because one of the things, of course, that you already see, you know, in bibliometrics, scientometrics, and so forth, is you've seen these network diagrams, right, that show how fields are connected to each other in terms of common reading patterns and common citation patterns and things of that kind. But here the idea would be to cut across that, right, to cut across that and to think about it in a kind of more broad-minded way, that in a way sort of operated on the assumption that there's already kind of a lot of knowledge out there that we could be exploiting, that's already been produced. But there is no incentive and there's no clear path to get to them because the disciplinary structures of the academy are blocking them. Okay? Now here I want to bring up something that... Now, by the way, this particular version of the problem, of course, was a problem that, you know... So Swanson makes his point, but then when you start to move into the 1990s, you start to see the rise of this field called knowledge management. Which, and I wrote a book called Knowledge Management Foundations in 2002, and this field, at the time I was writing it, was probably the biggest research area in business schools. And in a way, this was an area that developed very much in response to this, to a kind of, not I wouldn't say complete, but kind of nascent realization that there was a sense in which academic knowledge, enormous amounts of it was being produced, but it was in some sense being underutilized in all kinds of ways. Primarily because of the self-reproductive, self-reinforcing patterns of academic disciplines. And so what they did, what people in knowledge management began to do, was to develop programs that, what we normally talk about, data mining. Right? Now the thing about knowledge management, though, is, as you know, because it is part of the sort of business mentality, right, data mining is a typically very strategic thing. Right, so in a sense, a pharmaceutical firm, let's say, already has certain ideas about the kinds of things they're trying to pursue, and in a sense, they don't necessarily think that going to particular journals will give them the issue, so what they do is they then develop algorithms to help them go through loads of journals and loads of fields to find what they want, and that's data mining. Okay?
Stay tuned.
Yeah. And so I want to bring up the contrasting notion. That's how I'm going to end. Because this is the notion that we need to think about. Instead of data mining, data surfacing. Okay? And this is the idea that, in a sense, you relax a lot of your preconceptions about how you think knowledge is organized. And then, you know, in other words, you kind of let the data speak to you. Right? Because we do know... You know, in this era of big data in which we live, right, and one of the interesting things about that that everybody sort of kind of realizes is that the sorts of things that are available out there aren't quite cut into the categories we normally think about things. And that if we're going to make maximum use of that, we have to be very open-minded and not operate with the kind of, you know, conceptual frameworks in which we normally do, and that includes disciplinary frameworks. I don't know how many of you have ever heard of this phrase, data mining, data surfacing, rather, where it comes from. Do you know where this comes from? This comes from cybersecurity. Okay? This seems to me a good... Because, see, look, if you're in the terrorist spotting business, okay, if you're in the national security business, right, the sorts of agents you're looking for, the sorts of things you're looking for, are bound to be very elusive. And so, in a sense, what you're trying to do, and this is what data surfacing tends to do, is, and this is what might interest a lot of people here, is it tries to create images of data, you know, in other words, not just linear representations, but lots of different sorts of representations that start kind of triggering the imagination to think, there's certain kind of connections here we might not have seen before. Right? So there's a kind of a lot of art to this kind of thing, of data surfacing. And if you want to find out more about it, you go to the cybersecurity firm that the National Security Agency in the United States contracts, which is goes by the name of Palantir, in Silicon Valley, and I invite you to look at their website, because it seems to me that that kind of approach to looking at the full range of knowledge out there might be one that academics could learn a lot from in terms of breaking away from the sorts of constraints that disciplinary boundaries provide to even the knowledge they have already produced, let alone knowledge they could be producing in the future. And I'll stop there.
Thank you. break scene. Okay. So, we have 5 minutes for questions or observations or comments on Steve's very provocative presentation about data servicing and disciplinary boundaries.
Yeah.
Steve, so really fascinating talk. Thank you. And really provocative and a good way to start the day. But in terms of your thoughts about, if you like, new interdisciplinarity, isn't data mining an established area? Aren't we going to buy into, you know, an established practice?
No, this is why data surfacing is deliberately different. This is the point.
But data surfacing, aren't we going to be buying into other particular practices as well? So where, I mean, it's meant to be a provocative question. Where's the freedom in doing this?
Well, data surfacing isn't a science, you might say. I was very deliberate in using the word art to describe how this kind of thing goes. Because what Palantir basically does, if you look at their website, as far as I understand, is it doesn't just sell the NSA an algorithm they can implement to data surface, but rather they actually bring in one of their members of staff, right? So there's this like tacit knowledge thing going on almost, right? To help the people see, you know, to enable them to read the data in a way, in a more open kind of way, right? Which means that you have to kind of observe the preconceptions in action, and then you interrupt them, and then you get them to sort of see things more broadly, and you present things differently. And that's very difficult to do unless you're kind of there, you know, doing that, right? So it's a different kind of approach. So even though it does involve algorithms, it is not entirely algorithm-led.
Another question. Yeah, Richie?
I was really fascinated by this idea that we're very locked into particular sets of literature in a particular discipline, and there's all these incentives to sort of essentially play that game and cite the right things, depending on who your audience is. And it's the approach that I'm trying to take with my literature search, literature review, is to sort of draw from anywhere really that's talking about the issue that I'm looking at. But do you have any thoughts on how do you then deal with that if you're, you know, because in the end you're submitting to a journal, you're relying on them wanting to publish your work. If they don't buy into that view, if they want you to just be citing the, you know, the people that they're used to seeing, particular works that they're on board with, how do you get past that stage to actually?
To be honest with you, I think first of all that practice ought to be called out more. Okay, because one of the journals that, of course, practices this the most is Social Studies of Science. Right? Social studies that any of you have ever published with those guys, they always put a tax on you, right? Namely, you have to, right, this is where the rent-seeking comes in, right? Where you have to cite these two guys who published something remotely like what you wrote 6 years ago, right, to keep the impact factor of the journal up, okay? Now, it seems to me this kind of practice ought to be called out more. That's the first point, okay? And I do think there is going to be an issue, and this is another thing I think is vaguely hopeful, though perhaps in a more apocalyptic mode, is I think that the control that journals have over the production of knowledge is being disrupted in all kinds of ways already, okay? And the difficulty in finding people to review referee journal articles. I mean, there's a big crisis, I think, in terms of if you go into the fine-grained structure of how academic knowledge production takes place these days. That some of this stuff may be forced to disappear in the long term. That's my view. Especially if there are more outlets which have credibility, perhaps not in the strict disciplinary sense, but credibility by some other standard that people take seriously, then that could offset all this kind of parochialism that you see operating in journals all the time. That's my long-term guess about this. But I think it should just be called out. I think it's ridiculous. So I agree with you on that.
Great.
Steve, that was brilliant. Thank you very much. I'm sitting here trying to integrate your presentation with two HPS statements on interdisciplinarity, but I just thought I'd ask you to do it for me. One is Ian Hackie, who says in a famous little article that you never go to an interdisciplinary person if you want to know something. You always go to someone who's disciplinarily trained, but then applies their disciplinary training in a new direction. So disciplines kind of have a permanent place. Secondly, Simon Schaffer and makes this point that disciplines only ever acquire any stability in the polemics of people calling for their ends in the name of interdisciplinarity. Otherwise, they're heterogeneous, unstable.
That's bullshit. The latter is bullshit. No. As this question, I think, just pointed out, look, I mean, I'll deal with the first. The first one's a little more sophisticated, but the second one is bullshit. Because if you go back to what she was saying, right, disciplines do have a reality in practice in terms of how you get published, how you're accredited, and certain disciplines, of course, have very clear hierarchies of what journals matter, and those things matter with regard to people's ability to progress through the discipline that they're in, right? So you know, that's real enough for me, okay? And insofar as those things exist, disciplines do have a reality, okay? They might not get talked about a lot. So maybe Schaffer's trying to say something about a kind of discourse analysis of discipline, scare quotes, when do people talk about disciplines? But that's a kind of relatively bullshit point, right? I mean, disciplines have a reality, that's for sure. Now, what Hacking's saying is a little more interesting, okay? Because it seems to me that there is an issue about, you might say, discipline in the most general sense of the term. That's to say, a certain kind of, you know, the sort of thing that I guess we would normally associate with method. Right, namely the idea that you have a kind of focused way of going about things, a kind of systematic way of going about things, right? And so, you know, when Germans talk about Wissenschaft, right, the key thing about discipline is important there. It's a systematic body of knowledge that kind of goes somewhere, that is progressing in some kind of way. And so that aspect of discipline is in fact important. Whether it needs to be connected with a substantive area, you know, so that you end up having disciplines in a cartographic sense, right? Because this is the thing I'm really objecting to, is a kind of cartographic model of discipline, where each discipline is like a field in the literal sense of a piece of land, right? Because I think that's kind of the real objectionable aspect. It's not like, you know, one shouldn't have some certain kinds of skills, but rather that the discipline should be seen in that kind of a mode. That's the thing I'm mainly objecting to. And so I can kind of resonate kind of with what Hacking is saying, in that you definitely do want to talk about skills, you want discipline in the sense of a systematic vision, and so forth. So then I have some sympathy for it.
Last two questions. Yes, Joanna and then Amanda. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for that, Steve. I wondered if, sort of picking up some of the questions here, I'm not sure if you've seen Marilyn Strathern's Commons and Borderlands book, which is precisely about disciplinarity and interdisciplinarity, and she has quite a nice way of, so the idea of territorialization that you just kind of critiqued, so she's obviously addressing some of that. But she has, what I quite like about her way of thinking is the commons idea, that we need the discipline, we need to travel back to the disciplines, work as you're saying, and have our disciplinary depth and heritage and inheritance.
Well, I'm a little more open on that. I wonder, I don't know, I could push it to a certain extent, but not as far perhaps as you're suggesting.
So instead of, you said at one point something about interdisciplinarity of unification.
Yeah.
No, would be, I think the way that she would see it is about creating something that we can call common, something that say, yeah.
Yeah, but common only kind of makes sense if you've got a border around the commons at some point. An outer border, not an inner border, but an outer border.
Yeah, well.
I mean, so I'm not quite sure what commons mean, unless commons normally has a kind of outer boundary.
Yeah, but commons doesn't have to be territory. It can be things in common that we hold.
Sure, but I think knowledge production has a little bit more rules than that. I mean, this is the thing. I mean, I think this is where we start to get into the issue of what producing knowledge is.
I was talking about cross-disciplinary working,
sure.
Yeah, in the production of understanding, yeah. But when you're working across different disciplines, like you, it's something I've done all my academic life. You are fumbling.
Sure.
To find things in common which you can work with to open up understanding. Yeah.
In a sense, I don't disagree with this. I mean, in a sense, I'm not sure we're talking about things at quite the same level.
Yeah, well, let's see if Amanda Rees's question is in common with So.
Again, to echo what Greg just said, thanks for a really fabulous talk. Whenever I listen to you, Steve, I'm reminded of Lord Peter Wimsey. You know, the character, I find it very easy to get drunk on the words or just exhilarate. But the problem I
So you're going to sober us up, huh?
It's been football tonight for that. The problem I had with the talk was that it is words. And what I was thinking all the way through was exactly the point that Greg was touching on there, is this question of practice. I mean,
sure.
Not hit the kind of buzzwords of HBS or SDS. Where's methodology when it comes to interdisciplinarity? Because in my experiences, both working across disciplines and looking at controversies, studying controversies within disciplines, what they come down to is not the literature, not who you're citing, or only at the kind of meta level. What it comes down to is what you're doing.
Yeah.
So that's... Where's action?
I don't know what level to address this question, but it seems to me that anyone who's interested in pursuing knowledge should start off with the question that interests them.
Yeah.
And as it were, the disciplines come in as needed. Okay? So in other words, there is no... So this is why I don't like this heritage idea of disciplines, right? There's a sense in which that what you're driven by is the problem, right? And I think the most interesting thing about the notion of discipline as a systematic pursuit is that there's a drive, right? There's something that you're trying to get at, you're trying to understand, right? So you want to understand, you know, and this is where philosophy, to my mind, actually gives you some very good initial bearings on how to think about this. Because almost all the best questions have been set by philosophers but cannot be answered by philosophy alone, if by philosophy at all, okay? But nevertheless, the philosophers are very good at setting those questions. And I think that should always be kind of a driver, but then what you bring in to address it, to refine it, you should be quite open-minded about this, specifically if you have some kind of historical knowledge about the way disciplines have developed. And this is the point here. The reason why I don't like the heritage idea is because disciplines are profoundly path-dependent entities. It is kind of a historical accident that disciplines move the way they do. You know, I'm using accident not in a trivial sense, but in a sense that it could have gone other ways at other points. And I think that should always be in the back of our minds whenever we think about the significance that disciplines have in knowledge production. And this is, by the way, a role, I think, you know, because you tweeted yesterday, I believe, about what is the role of history if we're concerned about the future. It's this. Namely, you can go back to the points at which disciplines started to get locked in their ways and look at what the other alternatives were on the table and perhaps think maybe it's time to go back and pursue one of those alternatives given the changed circumstances of the world in which we live. I'm sorry, that's words, but you know.
Will you just make my presentation?
On that.